Hi, everybody, and welcome to our work together. We are beginning with number 59 in the Rays and Initiations webinar commentaries. And let's see, just a little bit of background, perhaps, as we have talked about the fact that aspirants must not confuse the teaching given to them by the master in the work of the ashram with this later state of the fusion of consciousness, wherein the new member of the ashram becomes an outpost of the master's consciousness. So we talk about the protection from the master's presence. We also talk about how lesser disciples and aspirants need to be protected from the presence, the radiations going forth from a more advanced disciple. We can have a potent effect, or the disciple, let's say, the more advanced disciple, the accepted disciple, can have a potent effect upon those whom they may contact. And this is caused without their intention. It's simply caused by the radiation that they give forth. So they do have to moderate and modulate that radiation. So applying this radiant energy is a definite mode of spiritual service and activity, but only those streams of energy are allowed to escape from the disciple, which are really appropriate to the need, and thereby the passing by of a disciple will not, in this case, produce much difficulty for the individual in the group, though it could if the disciple is not cognizant of those who may be receiving the energy. So the master has to be very careful about the kind of energy he releases, and the individual disciple can receive that energy, and it can have deleterious effect. It is a separative term, the individual disciple, and it is necessary that that sense of separation be overcome. The separative instincts of the disciple, the self-centered instincts, and they do last a while, must be overcome, and there will be instead a certain, well, what are the words here, a certain disinterestedness on the part of the disciple, and a certain inclusive spirit, which will make it possible for the master to throw his energy in a well-measured way in the direction of the disciple without the fear that individualism and egotism will be produced. So let us, you know, simply think of our conditions and whether, should that happen, whether we would suddenly become somehow proud and separative and, you know, less able to cooperate than we had been before the master had directed energy toward us. Okay, so now we're talking about contact leading to the desired fusion with the master's consciousness. There is such a thing, of course, as fusion with the soul, and D.K. has said an interesting thing. He says that your soul will introduce you to your master. This is interesting. The soul is, in a way, if we consider the solar angel, a much more advanced being than a master, having already been on the way of higher evolution and having returned to this particular solar system for service purposes. But let's just say the solar angel sending forth an aspect of himself to underlie the egoic lotus is, in a way, a divine intermediary. And our contact must first be with that part of the solar angel which is invested in the egoic lotus, the causal body. But, of course, our practical goal is to be acquainted with and carry out the will of the master of our particular ashram and the soul, soul or angel, knowing so much about this, helps to arrange that that may be possible. You know, it's a difficult thing. Obviously, we're not contacting the full measure of what the soul or angel is. We're contacting a fragment, having pervaded the entire universe with a fragment of myself, I remain. That entire universe, in this case, is the energy system of man, and a fragment is a certain aspect of presence in which the solar angel, through which the solar angel can be conscious within the causal body and egoic lotus of the human being, and yet more supremely conscious on its own level, which is higher and at least the Buddhic plane. And, well, I think the Buddhic plane of love wisdom is probably the place where many of these solar angels are focused in their fuller nature, but I would not necessarily make an ironclad ceiling about that. I think it's possible that some of them can focus on higher, still higher levels. I think they, of course, have their own rays as well, 1 through 7, as they have been evolving in a particular way on the path to Sirius and within the aura of the great star Sirius itself. The timing of all of these things really has to be worked out. The sense that scientists of the present day have about the duration of stars and systems may have to be adjusted. And, you know, that sense of timing has a lot to do with the outer manifestation of these centers, like the Pleiades, like Sirius. What goes on the inner level? How long do they stay there? Does the inner part of these beings remain? Remember, you know, Maya Virupas. I was talking to my friend Nicholas Nilan, and, you know, we were thinking maybe there's something about the Pleiades which is Maya Virupic. They are such advanced beings. So on the inner level, they exist, but when they wish to put in an appearance, just the way a human master or Chohan would, putting in an appearance through the power of Kriya Shakti, they can do so, although their appearance would be very lengthy compared with the appearance of a human being, but maybe not so lengthy as the duration of other external stars, which were not Maya Virupic in nature. Well, all of that is an advanced consideration, and one day we will know more about it. We hardly know about the mysteries of our own planet, yet alone the mysteries of of the great beings, the great Logoi, who inform the stars of the Great Bear, the major stars of the Great Bear, or the major stars of the Pleiades. We know so little, but we're on our way, and we will know more. The point is, we have to remain on our way. Well, okay, so we ended this, we'll be beginning number 59, and it's all about how to contact the presence of the Master, how to be an outpost of the Master's mind, maybe the Master's consciousness. Of course, there's more to his consciousness than just the mind, but this idea of being an outpost is on the way to truly representing the Master in some important sense. Just the way Apollonius of Tyana offered his vehicle, and even probably when he was in his own vehicle, he was representing the consciousness of the Master Jesus, and the way the Master Jesus offering his vehicle to the Christ was also representing in some potent way the presence of the Christ. I mean, he would be imbued by that Christ presence, and so he would not necessarily revert entirely to his customary psyche, but would be carrying that huge impression of the Christ, even when the Christ was not immediately and impressively overshadowing him. Of course, then, we don't know this for sure, but it does seem that the Christ from time to time took over the body of the initiate Jesus. He was an initiate then, not a master, and that the one speaking is definitely the Christ, and that the initiate Jesus is standing by while the Christ is speaking. Anyway, let's get on with this discussion of how the disciple, the initiate, can stand in the presence of the master and present no barriers to direct contact with the master's mind. So how does this work? Number one, occasionally in the disciples' hours of meditation, at a moment of great tension or in a crisis related to service activities. And what this means, of course, what he's trying to tell us here is not just a personal crisis, but in the line of spiritual work, there may occur a momentary fusion of the minds of the disciple and of the master. Maybe there are moments that we have experienced something approaching this or feel like we're getting closer to it. This can only occur when the mental focus is so steady and so firmly directed in intention that emotional reactions or the intrusion of personality affairs are eliminated. You know, the personality would like nothing better than to grab hold of such experiences and emphasize personality importance. IMPC. That's going to be importance. Okay, I hope so. IMPC. Yep. Okay. Importance as a result. So there must be a real objectivity about oneself, a detachment from one's lower nature, both personal and emotional, so that the mind can be held steady in the light, and it is part of the energy, the vital energy system, without awakening the Ahamkara principle, which brings about separativeness. See, this the sense of not so much individuality, but individualism. And the master wants to avoid that at all costs, because it would just set the disciple back in his progress. So we want to increase our points of tension in meditation so this type of merging can occur. And it's not a long time. It's what DK calls a momentary fusion. So let's just say we must increase our points of tension if we wish for this type of fusion to occur. I think we can see, you know, all of this is a lengthy process. There's no rushing it, but at the same time, there is no time to lose, as we are told in those six important rules of the road. Find them in Dina 1, I think. Later on in his training, the master may attempt to impress his mind unexpectedly, impress the disciple initiate's mind, probationary initiate, or maybe even third degree initiate, unexpectedly, and thus train him to recognize what we might regard as a direct call from the center of the ashram. And in the very last rule of healing, we see something about this. Maybe you're familiar with it. Maybe I can find it quickly, you know. So it's in esoteric healing, and you get the idea of what the ashramic call is all about. And the word is hearken, hearken, H-E-A-R-K-E-N, hearken, call. And, oh, I guess it repeats itself several times. Hearken, O Chela, to the call which comes from the son to the mother, and then obey. The word goes forth, that form has served its purpose, The principle of mind then organizes itself and then repeats that word, or the word. The waiting form responds and drops away. The soul stands free. Now, here's another call that's even higher. This is definitely a rising initiate that we're dealing with, and even one who's heading toward Shambhala. Respond, O rising one, to the call which comes within the sphere of obligation, where he is naturally focused in a Saturnian manner. Recognize the call emerging from the ashram or from the council chamber, one or the other, perhaps, depending on your degree of unfoldment, or from the council chamber where waits the Lord of Life himself. He is a great waiter until we have managed to fulfill the expectations of our own soul and our own deeper expectations and can come more directly to him. The sound goes forth. Both soul and form together must renounce the principle of life and thus permit the monad to stand free. It's a very advanced stage. The soul responds. The form then shatters the connection. Life is now liberated, owning the quality of conscious knowledge and the fruit of all experience. Thus are the gifts of soul and form combined. So this is a call. These are calls that reach us in our sphere of obligation, and they come from the ashram or from the council chamber. Well, what we're talking about now is pretty much the call coming from the ashram, and not yet in our own cases until we are true and confirmed higher initiates, and pretty much following the fourth degree, the call coming from the council chamber. So this is all progressive. The first part is contact with the master in moments of meditation. It kind of reminds you of one of the experiences of accepted discipleship. I think there are six experiences, or are there five experiences of accepted discipleship? Let's just check that out. I think maybe it's five. And okay. Let's see. Let's see how we do this. Okay, experiences. let's see, in meditation, experience in meditation, and maybe we'll call this dream experience, okay, or maybe in a dream, and let's see if we can find that, humanity itself, blah, blah, blah. One, two, three. Oh, maybe not, maybe not. Maybe I'm not going to find it this way. Okay, but the five stages are, let's see, how does the first one can be a dream experience, then an experience in meditation, then, you know, interview in the master's ashram. That's another way to find that. And let's see how we do. Interview. Yeah, interview. Only one. Oh, that's Dina 2. Ah, goodness. I'm in the wrong book. I'm sorry. Okay. Interview. And we should be able to get that. Two. There it is. A definite remembered interview in the master's ashram. So let's see how this goes. Yes, yeah, there we go. A vivid dream experience, a symbolic teaching, which we recognize as a teaching rather than just our own interest in symbols, a using of a thought form of the master, a contact in meditation, and a definite remembered interview in the master's ashram, the last two, I think, being definitely the stage of accepted discipleship. Well, anyway, we do see that we're, when we look at these five, something we're studying here reminds us that the master may attempt to impress the mind unexpectedly, and that can be that experience in meditation, or maybe the thought form of a master, something of that nature. And, of course, an interview is a direct interview where we are in the master's, let's call it his study, you know, although we probably symbolize these things to ourselves according to our imagination. But I think there is a certain realism there that at a certain point we can see and understand in reality. Okay, anyway, this is the place where the stages of accepted discipleship are really discussed. And of course, I would strongly recommend them, Little Chalechip, Shayla and the Light. And then these different kinds of internal experiences and Shayla on the thread and Shayla in the aura and Shayla in the Master's heart. And later comes the blending of the lights, which is the seven. But the third stage has five sub-stages to it, and that's what we are beginning to talk about. And we have to evaluate ourselves in terms of the possibilities. Anyway, all of this is about the blending of our mind or with the Master's mind and how that mind can impress us and how we can become an outpost of the Master's consciousness. Later, we don't know, you know, what we say, how much later, but later, there is impression that comes, and a call comes to him from the center of the ashram. And that's kind of interesting because we have been invoking the Master, and now the Master is evoked, we might say. We have been invoking the Master, and now the Master in evocative response impresses us with the quality of his energy or with a certain thought form or directive. We have to remain alert here, but not overly eager for the attention of the Master, because that way lies individualism and separativeness and pride and self-exaltation and all those things that make us feel that somehow we are special when Master DK tells us we ought to consider ourselves as quite ordinary. That's the safest way. Now, we go on. The third step. As the disciple proves his value and demonstrates that he is desiring nothing for the separated self, causes a pause, doesn't it? The interrelation between the two minds, that of the Master and the ashram and the disciple, finds no impediment. So again, you know, as you read, you test yourself against the requirements. We desire nothing for the separated self. Oh, it's a very exacting requirement, because after we're finished with the first levels of asking nothing for the separated self, we discover little requests, demands, hiding in our subconscious nature, perhaps, and we realize that we're not as selfless as we may have thought. So very scrupulous examination is required. So as the disciple proves his value, and, you know, pretty much, obviously, how do you do that? You're proving your value in service, right? Okay. And demonstrates that he desires nothing for the separated self, you know, so he has true selfless aspiration and not desire for the acquisition of something which relates to the personality, then the interrelation between the two minds of the Master and of the ashram, Master of the ashram and the disciple, finds no impediment. And I would just say, you know, that the more we read Master DK's work with care and, you know, with an earnest attempt to really understand what he's saying, and let that attempt be impersonal, not as if we're acquiring something for ourselves to build ourselves up in the eyes of others, you know, nothing like that, then closer and closer will come the approach, and one will begin to know what it is the Master is thinking in terms of the divine plan and the part in the divine plan which one may be able to help to manifest. There is consequently no risk of overstimulation, of smugness, right, of self-satisfaction, or of the emergence of qualities which would disturb the rhythm of the ashram. So this is when you might say, risk is gone, risk evaporates, when interest of the disciple, which we call it initiate, in his own personality is fast subsiding. There can take place, as the Master wills it, a flow of thought between the two. Now, you know, when will that happen? You know, I would say, when will it happen? Mostly during moments of service or attempts in service to convey the Master's thought. Of course, we don't all have to be on the teaching ray. There are many ways that one can convey what it is the Master seeks to impress upon those who may be influenced by him so that the divine plan may be more rapidly and better enacted. At first, the impression is carried forward entirely on the side of the Master, and the disciple is simply an agent who can be impressed by ideas and instructed along some particular line which may be of service to humanity. You know, so the question is, do we even realize when this is happening? You know, we all provide some kind of filter, filter or modifying quality as we attempt to present the Master's thought. So, you know, distortion can creep in. So at first, the impression is carried forward entirely on the side of the Master, you know, who judges perhaps our readiness for such impression. And the disciple is simply an agent who can be impressed by ideas and instructed along some particular line, which may be of service to humanity. Now, obviously, we can say of Master D.K., we can say that he reaches us potently through his books, if we read and study carefully. It seems obvious, but, you know, it's not just a book, it's the presence of the Master in his own words. He can, however, produce the disciple right now, in the beginning, can not produce any current of thought flowing back to the Master. So let's just say at first the disciple is only the receiver. And there is no dialogue. Later on, as the disciple moves forward into the light and is simultaneously a server, so, you know, it can be selfish to want the light only for oneself. He who stands within the light, he treads the way into the light, and he becomes absorbed within that light. So let's see if I can find that one. It's so good. I've quoted it many times when I can remember it. He who stands within the light is blinded, something like blinded by its radiance. Let's try that. Blinded by its radiance, blinded by, and then maybe the word, if I can do that. And well, I'm looking for this word radiance, you know. Okay, maybe I just put it in there and see what happens. Unblinded. Okay, well, it goes like this. Turns the other way. There's only one of them, and let's see what book it's in. Discipleship. He who faces the light. It's that's not stands within. That's why it didn't work. He who faces the light and stands within its radiance is blinded to the issues of the world of men. He passes on the lighted way to the great center of absorption. But he who feels the urge to pass that way, yet loves his brother on the darkened path, revolves upon the pedestal of light and turns the other way. He faces towards the dark, and then the seven points of light within himself transmit the outward streaming light, and lo, the face of those upon the darkened way receives that light. For them the way is not so dark. Behind the warriors, that's who we are meant to be, twixt the light and dark, we are warriors twixt the light and dark, blazes the light of hierarchy. So here we are on whatever page, I think we can find it in a minute, and this is such an important statement in terms of our attitude, how we should manage ourselves. Page 15 of Discipleship in the New Age, Volume 2. I'm always losing that, and I have to rely upon my memory, which sometimes fails me. You know, I sometimes know it, sometimes don't. But anyway, excuse me. Anyway, we refer to that. We refer to that great passage. And later on, as the disciple moves forward into the light, but not, you know, forward into the light in such a way that all he does is move into the light. He's blinded to the issues of the world of men, and he sees nothing else but the light. So let's put it like this. We do not, there it is. We do not want to be one of those who goes forward into the light and ignores the difficulty of our brothers. And there is something we need, and that's brothers. That we want to be not so much the Pratyeka Buddhas, we want to be the Bodhisattvas. And we revolve upon the pedestal of light. And so how do we produce this current flowing back to the Master? Well, I think it becomes quite automatic when our service is intense enough and spontaneous enough and real enough and self-forgetful enough. Later on, as the disciple moves forward into light in a balanced and moderate way and is simultaneously a server, because what I've been talking about here is the possibility of moving forward into the light and not necessarily being a server. He can be permitted to reach the Master with his own reaction to the impression. And then comes the possibility of the chela in the aura. In the aura or even in the heart. But that's much later. And then the dialogue is possible. But the dialogue would be a waste of time for the Master unless one was really a true self-forgetful server. If one is not a self-forgetful server, then the dialogue would be a waste of time. Okay, then comes the final stage, wherein the disciple can be trusted. You know, the Masters are very careful about granting their trust because they realize how many of the possible modes of deflecting, however temporarily, the disciple from the path. One can get thrown off by currents that one just doesn't expect or know how to deal with. I'm sure we all have experiences with that. So the final stage comes wherein the disciple can be trusted to be the initiatory agent of impression and of contact. And, you know, there we, I guess we can call it the beginning stage of that, is the chela on the thread, you know. We might say, and it continues to grow in intensity. This begins with chela on, let's call it chela on the thread. Okay. I know that looks like a weird kind of abbreviation, but we use it often enough, so it can be useful. On the thread. Okay, so, and is allowed to evoke the master's attention. You know, not just call for it, but the master will respond. Will respond. Thus, evocation. Evoke the master's attention and to penetrate to the center of the ashram, and let us say, where dwells the master. Students would do well to relate these four stages, well, we've been trying to do it, to the six stages of discipleship dealt with in the latter part of Discipleship of the New Age. And these four stages correspond to the final four considered in that book. And let's just see these. Okay, so this was number one. And let's just go back there for a minute. Six. Sometimes haste makes waste. Okay. Six stages of discipleship. And the last four, the last four are the 3, 4, 5, 6. This is the accepted discipleship, dream, teaching, thought form, meditation, interview. Okay, accepted discipleship. And then chela in the light, chela on the thread. Let's see, how does this go? The chela is taught how to contact the master's attention in emergencies. And then the chela in the aura, where he can set up an interview with the master, and then the stage where the chela can have the master's ear at any time. So if we have four stages over here, and the disciple is trusted to be the initiatory agent of impression and contact, that should be the stage where he can have an interview at any time. Now, going backwards here, the stage is this? He demonstrates that he desires nothing for the separated self. The master can contact him. This looks like chela in the aura. It doesn't look like a one-to-one correspondence, but DK tells us it is. Then there's the chela on the thread. And this is the impression of the mind of the disciple by the mind of the master, a direct call from the ashram, though the chela on the thread may have, in an emergency, asked for some kind of response. And then five experiences related to accepted discipleship, and we have here the master influencing, in a very momentary manner, the mind of the disciple. So it seems to be an automatic thing. So let me write these down so that we can think of them. We have to smooth it out just a little bit, but we can see the connection. So this is the five stages of accepted discipleship. Okay, so those are the ones that go with the very first stage of uniting with the master's mind. Okay. Five stages of accepted discipleship. Okay, and the next one, a direct call from the master's ashram, and this is called, if we compare it with the six stages of discipleship, the chela on the thread. I should have done it this way, you know. Why waste it? All right, chela on the thread. And then the next will be the chela in the aura. So one is a trusted chela, and one needs an interview, and this is called one within the aura. So we'll call this number three. Once the master has desired, once the disciples have shown he desires nothing for the separated self, there is an easy rapport between himself now and the master, and the master and him. So he can reach the master with his own reaction to the master's impression, and we'll call this chela within the aura. And I'll make a little abbreviation of that, as it's so important, or one within the aura, but this is, we'll call it this, chela within the aura. Okay. Okay, and finally, we have, this is chela within the master's heart, and the master trusts the chela to initiate the need of for an interview, and the master will respond. Once we reach this stage, the master will respond. So we call this the chela within the master's heart. Okay? Be nice not to have to write all that out, right? Chela within the master's heart. And we'll put it here. Chela within the master's heart. Capitalizing some and not others. And thereby we have this kind of correspondence that Master DK has wanted us to have. Nice, however, though, that I misspelled something. So chela within the master's heart, and I'll have to try that again to get it correctly. Chela within the master's heart. Okay. That looks a little more correct. Learning how to spell the word within. Okay. So, this is, we have here a correlation. Oftentimes, Master DK asks us to make correlations between different lists and processes, and here we correlate the four stages by which the mind of the disciple and the mind of the master can merge and blend. We correlate these four with the last four stages of the six stages of discipleship. Okay, so hopefully that's clear to us. These contacts are naturally in the field of telepathy. In other words, we're not necessarily dealing with materializations. Now, you know, maybe it was very interesting for Alice Bailey, and maybe it was the way Master Kutumi operated in when something very important had to happen, that he materialized one fine morning when everybody else was to church and Alice was alone in the house and kind of conducted an interview with her, basically saying she could be useful. And was it strangely something like if she would learn how to behave or wasn't such a naughty little girl or something like that? I'm sure she understood the gravity of the situation. So the contacts are normally in the field of telepathy, as was largely the case with Master DK and Alice Bailey. She did say, I recall, that Master DK became so intense, or there was so much intensity about the conveying of the words of the great invocation, that he very nearly materialized in the room. So it tells you that that isn't how they usually work. They usually work telepathically, but this was a tremendous transmission or conveyance, and that he was so intent that she felt that he was very close to putting in an actual Maya Varupic precipitation. So, these contacts are naturally in the field of telepathy, which is an aspect of the science of impression and are entirely in the realm of mental interplay. Now, what's going to be included there? You know, there are many stages of the mind, and even the intuition is a stage of the mind. So many are the stages of the mind, and even the buddhi or intuition is called the, quote, transcendental mind. And maybe nirvana, you know, the nirvanic plane, which is the atmic plane, and thus the third plane from the top of the cosmic physical plane, is also considered a mental plane. And maybe there's something that we should be calling nirvanic mind, which lies even beyond the buddhi. So just the way mental states exist for us on all the different levels of our personality, so they can all be interfused with the mind once a certain stage of evolution is reached. So this is possible with the higher beings who can interfuse the cosmic etheric planes, cosmic astral plane, with aspects of cosmic mind. Okay, so all of these things are entirely in the realm of mental interplay. I have dealt with the basic science itself in the book Telepathy and the Etheric Vehicle. It's one which I fear I have somewhat neglected. I hope this is, I heard one of those little pops, which I hope does not mean that suddenly I'm no longer speaking to you, but hopefully I am. Telepathy and the Etheric Vehicle. The relation considered above is between the instrument of contact used by the master, that of the higher or abstract mind, for the masters do not work through the lower mind at all, and the lower or concretizing mind of the disciple. So this is a big, big hint. And this hint, let's just say, tells us, this hint tells us the manner in which the master works to fuse and blend his mind, let's say his abstract mind, with our concrete mind. So we can realize how important it is for us to be working on the Antikarana, which unites our concrete mind with our abstract mind. The masters are therefore dependent upon the use of, it makes me think of like cryptomnesia, you know, where you read something, you don't know you've read it, then you come up with it as if it's your idea. But anyway, the masters are therefore dependent upon the use of the Antikarana, which the disciple is in process of building. Okay, you know, without that, maybe there's no way for the master's abstract mind to really reach into the disciple's concrete mind with that measure of light which the master seeks to convey. This is rapidly becoming part of the group Antikarana built. Notice he capitalizes one and not the other. The Antikarana of the disciple is simply the Antikarana, and the group Antikarana is a larger item, a larger faculty, and he capitalizes it. This is rapidly becoming part of the group Antikarana built by disciples working in the three worlds, but on mental levels, who have been admitted into the ashram. So it's almost like as you really make progress in building the Antikarana, it signals that you are on the verge of being admitted at least peripherally to the ashram. Well, and, you know, so often when one is approaching the second degree, as I've said before regarding the Antikarana, you know, Scorpio being that major sign which involves the second degree and having so much to do with the power of Mercury, which is needed in building the Antikarana. So as you approach that second degree, you really can be admitted into the ashram more successfully, I would say. Okay, you can see why, therefore, the teaching anent the Antikarana, here he's capitalizing the whole thing, was deemed by us, presumably the masters, to be timely and wise. And why is that? So that the relationship between the disciples' mind and the master's mind could be improved and brought into a more fused relationship. I don't think it can ever be the whole thing, you know. I mean, think of what's in the master's mind. It's just what he wants to convey, what he thinks the disciple may be able to assimilate. He can't do a download of the entire content of his mind, just the way the solar angel can't do a download of its entire nature without destroying the vehicle into which the download would be precipitating. Relationship to the ashram and contact with the master are dependent upon the existence of the Antikarana. Okay, well, that's such a powerful statement that it needs to be made very big, you know, somehow, and really emphasized in our consciousness. If so many people, you know, they get a hold of a thought form of the master found on the astral plane, but their Antikarana to the spiritual triad, which are the various planes in which the master actually does work, that Antikarana is not built. And so you know that they're just getting hold of the reflection and not the real thing. Relationship to the ashram and contact with the master are dependent upon the existence of the Antikarana, and we must remember it does not pre-exist the effort to build it. It's it will exist when we do build it. Okay, in the early stages of its creative construction, the Antikarana is adequate to permit some contact with the ashram and with certain of the disciples, though not with those of very high degree. Okay, this is a call to humility, but it shows that ashramic entry is facilitated by the building of the Antikarana. Later, as the Antikarana perfects itself, okay, you wonder if it's perfecting itself, maybe with the help of the higher agencies, or is increasingly perfected. Whoop. Whoop. Mouse falling. Falling mouse. Okay. Increasingly perfected, higher and more durable contacts become possible. We might say, not so fleeting, more stable, not so fleeting. There is a stage. There is a stage in Antikarana building called what? Called stabilization. And it is the fifth stage, and of course we're really, most of us, nowhere near that, per se. Now, something very strange is happening. I hope I'm hearing all these little bells going off, and I hope that this program is not a problem I usually use two computers and in order to reference what I'm doing, make sure it's coming through, and I'm hoping that I'm not disappearing from the other computer, otherwise the program may well end suddenly. The results of these developed and registered contacts are finally seen in the complete impressibility. At any time and without any effort on either side of the disciple's mind. So, you know, this may not be a complete blending and fusing, but the master can get through at any time, and the disciple is an instrument of the master and of the ashram. It is now so attuned to the ashram and to the master's ray quality. Now remember that, you know, because we're dealing here with the soul ray, and at least in ashramic purposes, not so much the monadic ray, I think. When dealing with impressibility, it is the soul ray we are focusing upon. Impressibility, is that a word? Okay, well, it looks like, we'll just have to try to make it a word. That the mind is one with that of the master at the center, reciprocal activity becomes possible. So let us be alert, let us be aware, let us be sensitive, let us be alert, aware, and sensitive to the impression which may come in one or other of the four ways mentioned. And these ways are progressive. Okay. We have to begin with where we are and contact what we can contact, and then eventually the final stage will be reached. But at first it'll seem like rather accidental, and then there will be recognition of the master's response, and then there will be a real reciprocity going on here, and the master can heighten his attempts to impress, and then there will come in a flowing back to the master in dialogue, and then the disciple initiate himself can initiate the contact and be assured of an interview in the master's ashram. Chela within the master's heart. Okay. So we seem to be pretty much now at the end of this program. I can't time these out exactly as if I were in a radio or TV studio, but they're pretty close to 1 hour, at least as I'm doing them now. So this is the end of Raise That Initiation Webinar Commentaries number 59, and we have gone from 5:45 to 5:47. So this is pages 5:45 in the book to 5:47. And the day is the 6th of February 2017. And our next work will be beginning of Rays and Initiations Webinar Commentary number 60, pages 5:47 to something. Usually we've been going about two or three pages about that. I'm not sure what day we'll do this. Maybe later today we'll see what may be possible. So, friends, again, let me say what I'm trying to do is offer thoughts, interpretations, ancillary thoughts, connective thoughts, thoughts which help to fuse the subject in our mind and, you know, impress it in our mind that You want to say mind, you know, holding the bridge of the nose. Master Moria tells you, when you want to impress something upon yourself and really remember it, hold the bridge of your nose or press on the bridge of your nose. Those are very practical first ray indications. So, but it's going to require that we really study this. And what I would recommend is, as you're going along through the commentary, just stop the program and ponder on something that Master DK may have said, or maybe on something that I've said if you find it interesting or indicative, and then go on. Don't feel you just have to let the program run. Yes, it will take you longer if you do it that way, but you will get more out of it. Of that, I'm quite sure. So, we will see you for program number 60. And, so far, there have been 59 programs done in the second part of the Rays and the Initiations. It's an extremely important part of the book, and it deals a lot with initiation, as we will see as we go along. Okay, all the best, many blessings, and we'll see you for number 60. Bye-bye.